Review. So cooking, there was actually two components to our cooking discussion last week. One is on the biblical level, and one is on the rabbinic level. Let's do biblical real quickly. What was the definition that we developed for cooking on Shabbat? It's taking something which is raw or inedible and making it edible through heat. There's a second element to the definition as well. Not only making something edible from an inedible state, you use some pretty fancy terminology in your homework, from a state of inedibility to either machal ben drasai or machal ben sarcho. Ben drasai is a thief. A thief would eat something on the run, something which you would probably never eat. Something takes an hour to cook, and 30 minutes, it's edible, but you would never really eat it that way. That would be still considered cooking. We talked about this. And the second aspect is, who remembers the second aspect of the biblical definition of cooking? Not only rendering a raw item edible via heat, but also, think of a carrot. You take a carrot, it's cold, tastes delicious, but you'd like it soft. You'd like it, right? So it was edible already. So what did you do? Is that cooking? If I take a carrot and I soften it up through heat?
Yes.
It is. So what's that? That's the second aspect of the definition. What's that?
Changing the state.
Yeah, it could do that. We called it increasing the characteristic of edibility. You know what I'm saying? Or enhancing its edibility. All right, it's a little more vague. It's a little gray. It is a little gray, but I guess changing its state would be another way. So how do you get around cooking on Shabbos then? You just don't cook on Shabbos. You cook in advance of Shabbat, but you want to have hot food. So what do to have hot food on Shabbat?
You can warm it.
What's that? You can warm things up. So if something's on from beforehand, and you've already cooked the food, what kind of food?
Solid.
What's the problem with liquids? Good, because what happens when something cools down and you reheating it is not simply reheating it, it's actually cooking it. That's the definition of cooking when it comes to a liquid. What is cooking with regard to a liquid? It's boiling it. So if it cools down, even though it's already been cooked, what do we say by something solid? We say, ein bishul achar bishul. Once something is dead, you can't kill somebody twice. If something is cooked already, you can't cook it again. It's already been cooked.
But how again do we have hot tea and sugar?
So that's what we discussed last week. We'll come back to that in a second.
Yeah.
Because why? Go ahead.
Because you're changing from initial vessel to secondary vessel to tertiary vessel. Tertiary vessel, you know.
Excellent. Do you remember this?
Sure.
I remember.
Let's do it again. Can I get some more seltzer? Please.
Can you just put your soup in the tertiary vessel?
Yeah. So technically,
tertiary.
It was cooked.
Oh, you were in here.
The third one.
No. This is only applying to a solid still. Because what you're not cooking the water for tea. You're not cooking the water. What are you cooking when you make tea? You're cooking the tea leaves. So if you want to do this, we talked about this last week. This is actually not great. Let's very, very briefly. I need that. I need some props here. Can I borrow that?
Yes.
So make believe this is your hot water urn. Your hot water urn is plugged into the wall. This is called what? In Hebrew words, it's called a kli rishon. Why is it called the first vessel? Because that's the vessel in which the item has actually been cooked. Okay, a kli rishon. It could be a pot. It could be a urn. Kli rishon. When I take the kli rishon and I pour its contents into another cup, that second cup is called kli Sheni, a second vessel. The Talmud says, Kli Sheni ain't a mevashel. A second vessel doesn't have the capacity to cook like the original one does. Just biochemical reality. Tea bags technically could go right in here, except there's an exception for things that are too easily cooked, like tea leaves that get very quickly and easily cooked. We are a little more stringent and we will say, take your water from the second vessel, this is the first, pour it into the second, you then take it, pour it into the third, and then you take the tea bag in here and you have your tea on Shabbat. That's how you avoid cooking on Shabbat. You're not boiling the water. Boiling the water would be a problem. That would be cooking. What we're doing is we're basically removing, thank you, keep that fizz, What we're doing is we're keeping the we're making sure that we're not actually cooking the tea leaves. That applies to coffee, instant coffee. How did we say last week? You could have freshly brewed coffee on Shabbat.
A timer.
Okay, you can do that. And there were two rabbinic concerns that we discussed last week as well. So you have the biblical concern that you're actually cooking. There's another concern, though. What's the other concern?
God, it's hot.
We're concerned that you're engaged in activity that looks like you're cooking. So what would such an activity be? Let's say you left your stove on from before Shabbat. The flame is right there. And you want to take something that was previously cooked, put it right on the flame. Are you doing anything wrong, biblically speaking?
No.
You're not, because?
Because you can heat up dry.
Because you can reheat dried foods, right? But what were the rabbis concerned? Two concerns. You mentioned one, it looks like you're cooking. You don't want to get too involved in any activity that too closely resembles the forbidden activity. And what's the other concern?
Someone comes to stalk.
You might come to?
Stalk the calls.
What does that mean, stalk the calls?
You,
and what will that be today in the 21st century?
Turn up the heat.
You might come to, this is what the rabbis came along, not to make your lives more difficult, but to ensure that we don't violate the Torah itself, which is increasing a flame. And therefore, what we do is we put a blech over it. What does the blech do? The blech takes care of those two rabbinic issues. Issue number one, Shema Yechate B'Gechol, we might come to stalk the coals. Give me a scenario. By the way, this is very likely. The rabbis didn't make things up that were just ridiculous. You have company coming over, and you've got this chicken. It's Saturday afternoon, and you want to heat it up because it's much nicer to have warm chicken than it is cold chicken or a piece of kugel. So you take it out of the fridge. Your oven is on from before Shabbat, so you're totally cool with that. Your oven is on from before Shabbat. Uh-oh, company's here already. I need to get this thing moving. You just put the flame up, and then you've just violated one of the 39 acts of work. It's called Havara, which is increasing the flame. So, now, is it guaranteed if you put a blech over it, you won't do that? No. But it's much less likely to do that. And there's actually a debate, what is blech is? Should it cover the knobs, or should it cover the heat source? Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion it should cover the heat source. Avraham Cutler said it should cover the knobs. We usually go like Rav Moshe, cover the heat source. Some people, super stringent, will have the blech, like a piece of sheet metal over it, with a lip that comes down and covers the knobs too. Simpler, and in my opinion, safer way of doing this. You don't have to keep the oven on all Shabbos. What's a plata? A hot plate. Use a hot plate. Very, very simple. You want hot food on Shabbos. You take your dry food, your chicken, your kugel, whatever it is you want to heat up, just not liquid. You take it out of the fridge, put it right on that hot plate, and you're good to go. Questions. I see a lot of confused faces. I wanted to jump into the next topic, but I see confusion. I don't want confusion. I want clarity. How can I help? Alex, you got it? It makes sense? Listen, let me just tell you, I'm not telling everyone what to do, what not to do. I'm just trying to explain. I wanted to dive into one malacha with you, one of the 39 acts of work, so you can see how sort of it's operating in a very, very practical way. But that's why it's technically possible to have, and that's why most people do have, nice hot food on Shabbat afternoon. Friday night's never an issue, because Friday night you just cook the stuff, leave it in the oven until the company's there or you want to start eating dinner. Just make sure to turn your oven off. Your inside of your oven off before Shabbat. Why is that? If you're going to leave some food in there. Because? Because if you open it up, what happens? Besides the light, possibly? The heat goes up, the thermostat goes wild. And there was an attempt at some point to create a blech for the inside of the oven. But they can't really figure out, in most ovens, how to regulate things in such a way. So they have these things called Shabbat ovens. I don't have one. Does anyone here have a Shabbat? It's called a Shabbat oven. What's it?
Yeah,
we have a warming drawer. It's a little different. It's a little more of a... The warming drawer basically is just, it's the same temperature, there's no thermostat on it. And therefore, you can just take stuff that's previously cooked and stick it in there and it warms it up a little. But it doesn't really get it piping hot. What really gets things piping hot is a I need you to fill in the blanks. I'm blanking. Is a hot plate. A hot plate does it, or a blech. A blech is like sort of piece of sheet metal there. Carly, I apologize to everyone for not having the tape for next week, but we are taping now. Yeah, we'll figure it out. Yes, we are. Okay, any other questions or comments about this? So that is a very interesting mix of biblical and rabbinic operating together. The topic I want to discuss with you tonight is, according to most opinions, purely rabbinic. And this has to do, I sent out an article, it was an interesting article about Elvis Presley, who was actually a Shabbos goy. Has anyone heard of that term, a Shabbos goy? Every community has a Shabbos goy. By the way, sometimes we don't like the word goy. You should just know that the word goy just means nation. It refers to someone outside of the Jewish nation. It's not really a derogatory term. Maybe some people use it in that way. So if you don't like it, I won't say it anymore. But it's kind of really sad. The first rule about Shabbos goys is make sure that they're actually a goy. Make sure they're actually... Because according to a lot of historians, Elvis Presley was actually Jewish. Even though when he was... Before he was famous, Elvis, and I know this for a fact because MGE's first rabbinic intern, Judah Dardick, who now lives in Israel... He was a rabbi in Oakland, California for about 8 or 9 years. Before him, another rabbi was the rabbi in Oakland, California, who was a colleague of mine whose name I'm forgetting. And before him, the rabbi in Oakland, California was a rabbi first in Memphis. This goes back. And he had a relationship with Elvis. He wrote an article about it, and when Elvis was a teenager and they needed the lights on in shul and they needed something, he was kind enough to come and turn things on. So Elvis was the first very famous Shabbos goy. But my question is, we have this in synagogue. Why is it okay? And those of you who come here on Shabbat will know when you get into the elevator, unless you like to brave the 10 flights. You get into the elevator, there's someone there pushing the button for you who's purposely not Jewish. Why is that okay? When is it okay to do this on a personal level? Because if you have enough friends who happen not to be of the Jewish faith, and they can do you a favor here and there, you can get a lot of your stuff, which otherwise is forbidden, done. And when is it okay? When is it not okay? And is this something that the Torah forbids? So follow with me on your handout. I prepared this for our discussion tonight. There are actually three reasons for what's called in Hebrew Amira La'akum, non-Jewish help on Shabbat. The rabbis forbade us from depending on non-Jews to do things which are otherwise forbidden for us to do. But with every rule, there's an exception, especially when rabbinic law. When the rabbis created a law, they did it to ensure that the sanctity and holiness of Shabbat would remain intact, but they did it in a way that would be doable. So there are exceptions, so that it's actually doable. The Rambam, the great Maimonides, writes, follow me in the Hebrew and the English, Asur lamor lenachrid, it is forbidden to tell a non-Jew, lasot lanu melacha b'shabbat, to do something for you on Shabbat, even though your fellow non-Jew is not commanded to keep the Sabbath. What are our fellow non-Jews commanded to do, as far as Judaism is concerned? Does anybody know? The seven Noahide laws. Is keeping the Sabbath one of the seven Noahide laws? No, it is not. So you can't say that that's something they're obligated to do. So if they're not obligated to do, the afal pi sha'amar lo mikodem, Rambam says, even if I told the guy before Shabbos started, do me a favor, I'm one of these crazy Orthodox Jews, I don't turn the lights on, I want you to come into my apartment at 8:30 tonight and put the lights on so we can enjoy dinner, I don't want to waste electricity until 8:30. The Rambam says you can't do that, and even though he's not commanded to keep Shabbat, and even though you are doing it before Shabbos, you're asking him, the af pi shein tzorach lo to melacha ela acha Shabbat, maybe you're even asking your fellow non-Jewish friend, your colleague, to do something for you that will only benefit you after Shabbos. All of those are forbidden. Why? And he says they're forbidden from the rabbis. It's midrabbanan, it's not biblically forbidden. The Torah does not say anywhere the a non-Jew can't do it. The only non-Jew that the Torah talks about is when a Jew may have a servant who is a non-Jew, and everybody has to be given off on Shabbos. Nobody can work for you. Now, we can talk about this offline. If you have a business and you have non-Jewish employees, can they work for you and make money for you on Shabbos? Technically, they cannot, but there are ways of dealing with that. And I don't want to get bogged down with that. If you have a business and you have non-Jewish employees, talk to me privately. We can discuss it. There are actually partnerships, contracts, things that you can do to disassociate yourself from the business so that you're not making money off your non-Jewish help on Saturday. That's a separate issue, and I want to deal with that right now. What's the reason, says Maimonides, that the rabbis didn't want us relying on non-Jewish help on Shabbat? I put it in bold, Shalom Tehei Shabbat Kala Be'inehem. So the Sabbath does not become light in your eyes. What does that mean? Who can tell me what that means? So the Sabbath doesn't become light in your eyes. Why would the Shabbos become light? Not light like this, but not serious. What do you think? So what's wrong with things being easy? Why does Judaism have to be so hard? What is light? What does it mean, light? Okay, that could be technically, meaning if you know, so you can always rely on your non-Jewish help on Shabbat, or your non-Jewish friend on Shabbat, then like, oh, I don't have to prepare from before Shabbat. That's interesting, yeah?
So it won't be taken lightly.
It won't be taken lightly. That's really what it is. And how will it be taken lightly? Because the bottom line is, all of these restrictions and all these things to create this holiness and sanctity can be so quickly lost. With a timer, with a friend who can just do it for you. And then we're just fooling ourselves. That's why we discussed last week this whole raging dispute and controversy over timers. You know why it's such a controversy? Because we could time everything. We could figure out very easily, you know, I can't obviously because I don't know what I'm doing with technology, but most normal people could figure out very quickly and very easily how to technologically rig their homes so that, you know, the TV can go on here, the this can go on there, and pretty soon, Shabbos just won't be Shabbos. That's what the Rambam is saying. Second theory, Rashi. Everyone heard of Rashi, the great biblical commentator, lived in France and then Germany. Rashi says, V'davar davar. The reason the rabbis forbade asking a non-Jewish friend on the Sabbath to do something that's otherwise forbidden for you to do is not because of the activity, or not because Shabbos will be taken lightly, but because of the speech itself. You know, Shabbos, the way we talk, is supposed to be a little different. I was once at a Shabbos table and they said, you can't say that. It's Lashon Hara and it's Shabbos. What's Lashon Hara? Gossip. And one of my kids said, I thought Lashon Hara was forbidden all week. You're never supposed to gossip about anyone. That's a joke. I thought you'd laugh earlier. But it's, if you think about it, right, so what do you mean? So what kind of speech are we supposed to try to stay away from on Shabbos? And by the way, this is hard. This takes a lot of discipline. What's that? Business? Just the grind. Stay away from the grind on Shabbos. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're involved in some interesting work, like Alex, and Mazel Tov again, Alex. Alex is involved in some very, very important work. Does that mean at the Shabbos table, accessibility for people with disabilities comes up, Alex can't talk about it because that's his job, that's his business? No. We're talking about the very technical, money-making stuff that is involved with your work. So I guess I have to shut up on Shabbos about all my fundraising. Everybody's got things they have to do to just make money. Okay? Maybe as a doctor, you have to bill people and deal with insurance. Stay away from that kind of discussion, but nothing wrong with talking about the human anatomy or biology, physics or chemistry. In fact, those are very appropriate discussions on Shabbat. Rashi suggests that the reason we shouldn't ask our non-Jewish friends is because not only are we supposed to disengage from melacha, but we should disengage even from discussing it. And therefore, according to Rashi, you would think maybe, ooh, that's where that hinting stuff comes in. You ever see people like, I'm not going to tell them to do it for me, but I'm going to hint. The reason people hint is because they figure they can get around Rashi. You know, because Rashi's all about the talk, so if I don't really say it, I just kind of imply it, maybe it'll be okay. And there are instances where the hinting actually does help in the areas of exception. Leroy. Yeah.
And so it's kind of the same thing. Like, if you're telling somebody else to do it, it still wouldn't happen unless you yourself did it. So in a way, you're kind of doing it yourself.
Sure.
But otherwise, like if I tell somebody, can you keep the cup for me? Had I not said that, it would not have been heated. Therefore, I'm the one.
Very good.
Positively heated.
And look at number three. Baruch Shekivanta. Mm-hmm. What is it? Look at number three. Rashi gives a second reason. Very good. By the way, anytime you say something and you come up with a brilliant idea that one of the great rabbinic sages did, you say Baruch Shekivanti. So, blessed is God that I was able to... That's what Rashi says, Shlichut. When you say to something to someone else and they do it, they have become your agent. And Shlucho Shel Adam Kamoto, the Talmud says, your Shaliach is like an extension of your own arm. Which is why if I send Carly to do an errand for me, or I say, well, it wasn't me. You know, it's like, you know, some like the mob, they used to send these, like, used to, you know, they send like a hitman. It wasn't me. No, you go to jail, you paid the money, you appointed, you had this person serve as your agent. It's like you did it yourself. So that's why, if you look underneath where Rashi, I underlined it, Vareish Luchot L'Sienu B'Shabbat. So on Shabbat, basically, asking an non-Jew, look at the bottom, the prohibition involves basically four things. Asking a fellow non-Jew to perform any one of the 39 acts of work, a malacha on Shabbos. Asking a non-Jew on Shabbat to perform a malacha after Shabbos. Whose theory would that partake of? Take a look at the three theories we just advanced. We said number one, Rambam, so Shabbos won't be light in your eyes. Two, forbidden speech. And three, agency. Look at number two. Asking a Jew on Shabbos to perform a malacha after Shabbos, is it a problem according to the Rambam? Shabbos will not be taken lightly? No, you're not. He's not doing anything for you on Shabbos. But according to Rashi, it's a problem. Why is it a problem according to Rashi?
Speech.
Very good. What about number three? Asking an Jew on a weekday to perform a malacha on Shabbos. Let's say on Tuesday, you call up your friend and you say, listen, started keeping Shabbos. I'm going to need your help Friday night. Right? So now you don't have the speech problem because the speech took place on Tuesday. But what do you have? Now you have the Shabbos not being taken lightly. Or perhaps agency. And finally, benefiting from halacha performed by a non-Jew on his own initiative. It doesn't take long for your non-Jewish friends to figure out the crazy life you're now living. And they realize, you're sitting, I had this a few weeks ago, I was sitting in a room, and the light went out, it was on a timer, and it went out early, and I was like squinting to be able to continue to read the book I was reading, and Medina, who works with us, and we're very, very close with her, she's Muslim, and she's actually very knowledgeable on certain areas of Islam, but now Judaism, so she sees me sitting, and she right away turned the light on. Is that a problem?
No.
Why? Don't give me like you're emotional. Look at them. I just spent 20 minutes going through all this stuff. She's like, it doesn't feel like a problem. Look at this sheet. Well, hold on. I did not ask her, so I don't. I'm not in violation of Rashi. There's no forbidden speech. Is she my agent? Well, I didn't really put her up to it. She's not my agent either. But
number four.
I'm still very good. Evan, very good. I'm still benefiting from a malacha. By someone who isn't Jewish, they did it on their own initiative. Because, again, even if he didn't say anything, people can figure this stuff out pretty quickly. Now, I'm going to go through exceptions in a few moments, but let me just get some comments or questions from you. The exceptions are pretty broad, but they don't eat up the rule, so to speak. Okay, so you're still left with a prohibition, but you'll see the exceptions make it very, very doable. Yes, Alex.
This is a politically correct question. Of all the Orthodox Jews that I've come to know very well, especially in the last year, this one thing about non-Jewish help on Shabbat is
right.
The one that's violated like the most.
Yeah.
You know, why is that? Why is this true?
Well, you're hanging out with the wrong people, obviously. I'm just kidding. God forbid. First of all, we're always supposed to give people the benefit of the doubt. You know that in life. So what might look like they're doing something inappropriate may not necessarily be. There might be a basis for it. You're going to see the exceptions in a few moments. Why is it okay? We rely on it. Every synagogue in the world, you think they leave the lights on all Friday night? Keep the heat on all Friday night? Keep the air conditioning on in the summer all Friday night? No. Someone who isn't Jewish turns it off. and turns it back on in the morning. Why is that okay? We're going to talk about that in a minute. I don't know if that's what you saw. It also, if you are at a large gathering in your home, because there are exceptions for the community. When does your home become a community? 3 people or 30 people? We'll discuss that in a few moments. So I don't know what you saw. So sometimes you want to give, you know.
I'm saying it as a generalization. I mean, obviously folks who work super hard to abide by the Erev and, you know, do all kinds of things. And
but this particular, yeah. So I will say there's a decent amount of ignorance in the Orthodox community in this particular area. I will admit that. Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of knowledge about this. I think not everybody studies so much, you know what I mean? To like know all the time. Yeah.
What about the nannies?
Good. What about all those nannies? So it is, and I'm going to go through the exceptions in a minute. The nanny, or whatever kind of help you might have for your children or the home, they cannot do anything you could otherwise not do. They're just another set of hands to help you with the kids, help you get things together, but it's not like they can perform malachot for you. They can't, unless it falls under the one of the exceptions. And if it falls under one of the exceptions, then they can't. And they're a decent number, so I'm going to start running through them. But, Evan.
Like in a situation like the one where, you know, she put the light on for you without, you know, you knowing, like, should you be, like, running away and not...
I technically have to leave the room, which is what I did. And she's like, oh, I forgot, you're not even supposed to benefit from what I did. Like, she remembered, you know. You're technically not supposed to, unless it falls under one of the exceptions. One of the exceptions is increasing the light. If you have a little light in the room already, then she can make more light. But if it's no light, turning on a light and turning off a light is okay too. Because, and a lot of technicalities here, the reason you can ask someone who isn't Jewish to turn a light off for you on Shabbat, but you can't have them turn it on. Can anyone figure that out?
Instruction is to turn it on, not turn it off.
It is forbidden also to turn off a light on Shabbat. Midrabbanan, rabbinically, whereas to put it on is biblical. What's interesting, though, also is that it's not considered a direct benefit. Let's say I can't sleep. I forgot my bedroom on. This happens all the time. I forgot the bedroom light on. Oh, you know, and now I can't sleep. So all you're asking your friend to do is to remove a situation that's preventing you from blah, blah, blah. You're not asking him to do something proactively, deliberately, in violation of Shabbat. You're asking him to remove something. And since that prohibition is rabbinic itself, there's basically a leniency for that. So there's a difference between on and off. Big difference. But let me go through. You had a question?
Okay, I have a question about, like, the Shabbos be only for Jews. It's like because like we have like in Exodus 12:49 and Numbers 15:16, we have like Moshe told like the same rules be for Jew and for strange, and specific about the Shabbos in Exodus 23:12. They tell it's like maybe I mean.
No, I'm familiar with the verse. I know what you're referring to. It's a good
question. Yeah.
So that is if people, that's discussing the other issue, which I didn't want to get into,
okay.
Which is if this person is in your employ.
Okay.
Let's say at, you own a business and you have, you know, employees who happen not to be Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
You're technically not supposed to work them on Shabbos.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you do that? How do you run a business if it needs to continue to run on Saturdays? Not so simple. There are people who actually specialize in this area of rabbinic law, who help people sign contracts to divorce themselves financially from ownership rights in the business on one day of the week. It's not so simple. Some people are against that and say that you can't have anybody working for you on Shabbat, period. The whole company has to not work on Shabbat. What about your website? Can your website be on Shabbos? You're not doing anything, but the website is still doing business. Or you have other people doing business on the website. It's a very, very good question. So there are ways to deal with it. It's not so simple. I wanted to really just focus on the home because I think it's a little more practical. Yeah, Alex.
Temperature. Temperature is one that I've seen some folks who adjust the temperature either because it's okay to do so or it has to help. How is temperature treated?
So the Talmud says, I'm going to get to this, that Hakol Choli Eitzel Kar, everybody's considered a sick person when it comes to cold temperature, not hot. Can't get sick from sitting in a hot, uncomfortable room for too long. It's just uncomfortable. But if you sit in a cold room for too long, you will get sick. And therefore, it's perfectly permissible in the first instance to ask someone who isn't Jewish to turn the heat up. It's not a problem in most of our apartments anyway, because the heat is just, you can do it yourself. I'm saying when the heat involves electric. If the heat doesn't involve electric and it's just opening up the, what is this?
Valve.
The valve. It's a fancy word. Opening up the valve, then that's perfectly. Let me go through the exceptions. It's going to become more clear. Yes?
Literally 30-second pause. Can we get some B-roll? You guys are such a great-looking group, learning from such a scholar here. We'll give you a couple just directions, and maybe you guys can just go with it. One of them is say something, and everyone, laughs, a boisterous laugh. This is all going to be edited down. It's a great annual dinner media that you...
So... relying on your a non-Jew for the elevator because it is two rabbinics and a mitzvah involved of prayer would be permissible. Your question?
What about going home? Because there's no mitzvah involved, technically.
Going home for what? So if you're going home to eat one of the three meals of Shabbos, then that would be okay. If you're going home to study some Torah, maybe you're going to open up my book or some other Jewish book. That's a mitzvah to study Torah. You got to be creative. I think it's okay. The Talmud also says that you could, if two rabbi, even if it's not just a mitzvah, but there's a great need, and 10 flights is a need. If you're in really good shape, 10 flights maybe is not a need. It's a very subjective thing. If somebody is much older, 2 flights might be a need already. I'm just giving you guys some tools. You can figure this out on your own. You apply the scenario in to the situation. You're right. I mean, I'll tell you, as a physician, you should just know my uncle, he should live and be well. He's still practicing as a doctor. He's 90, my father's older brother. Years ago, he called his rabbi Walter Wurzberger, who was a great, great scholar, student of Rav Soloveitchik. And he said that every time he got a house call on Shabbos, doctors used to do this thing called house calls, he'd get in the car on Shabbos. When he got a call that somebody really, was a serious situation, he would drive there, and he'd have to spend the rest of Shabbos there, be away from his family. And he asked Rabbi Wurzberger, and Rabbi Wurzberger said, it's perfectly permissible for you to come back home if not coming home is going to deter you to take another call. Because of pikuach nefesh, because of a life-threatening situation, is so important. We want to give the doctor the opportunity to be as available as possible. And if you're in some other place, this is before they had cell phones and all that as well, then you're less likely to answer a call, which we don't want. It's a little different than what you brought up, but it's kind of going back, to prevent a substantial financial loss. That sounds very Jewish. To prevent a substantial financial loss, it's okay to ask someone who isn't Jewish, let's say fix something. Good example, you have a well-stocked refrigerator and it just goes off. Let's say if the plug remains in disconnected, the food is going to spoil. Let's say the plug got disconnected and you have hundreds of dollars worth of meat in the freezer. And if you don't get that freezer working in the next hour or two, you're going to lose a lot of money. You could ask someone who isn't Jewish to put the freezer back on for you.
Could you call them?
You can't. Because you could ask them, but you can't...
Not always around.
So that's a good question. No, it's a very good question. That's a very, very good question. So you'd have to look around. You couldn't do that yourself. Even you'd have to lose the money, probably.
You're in the middle of Maya Hashirim.
Right. This happened to me. I think I told you this. This happened to me at my rabbi's home in Jerusalem. After we went into his kitchen to wash for Hamotzi, everybody was standing around the table. Did I tell everybody this story? I thought I did. I leaned on all of his light switches at the same time. I turned every light switch in the man's home off. And 30 people were standing in the pitch black. And we're in the old city of Jerusalem. So we ran around. We looked for an Arab to come. And he put the lights back on. If we could not find somebody, we would have had to have remained technically. I'm not telling you what to do. You think I'm a nuts. But you technically, you have to sit in the rest of the meal in the dark, which is very unpleasant. What's your question?
If the town is goyless.
I understand. So you're stuck. What do you want me to do, man? I mean, this. Yeah.
The meat's getting spoiled.
Isn't there something dangerous about eating in the dark?
If
you could turn the light on.
So that's the thing.
You could stab someone while you're cutting your meat.
Right. So you'd have to. Here's the question. You'd have to come up with something like that. You know, lawyer. You'd have to come up with some kind of.
I've cut my own finger trying to.
Well,
eat, you know. Yeah. Who knows how many limbs you cut off?
I'm not eating dinner with you, even with life. Yeah, question? Yes, Evan.
Because there are some instances where you could like do it in a different way.
Yeah, so that knocks things down another notch, which is true. If you're really, really stuck somewhere, you know, and you can't find, you're in a goyless situation, I'm not saying you should do this in the first instance. Let's say you're on the 33rd floor, and you don't want to walk 33 flights down. And you can't get the elevator sent up to you, right? Because what you should try to do is talk to the elevator guy downstairs, the concierge, to send up. This is what I did when I used to live on a higher floor, and we didn't have somebody. So I would say, do me a favor, send me up the elevator at 8:30, 8:45, and 9. I did this for 2 years when I lived on the Upper East Side. And he was very kind. Every, you know, tipped him really well on Christmas time. But 8:30, 8:40, 5, and 9 o'clock. And then he'd have to get in the elevator, which some buildings can do that from their desk. But some have to actually get in the elevator and push. Once you get in, and push it so you can get down. Because the elevator doors will open for you. You will then go in, and nothing will happen. So, they, you know, you can ask him a favor to do that. That's perfectly permissible. Otherwise, you should just take the steps. Ideally, you know, if you're trying to keep these things, it's not perfect.
Hold on a second, it's a fact check. Your refrigerator's out. You got hundreds of dollars of meat.
Depends how many hundred, honestly. You're in a goyless town.
Can you make a phone call?
Did this happen?
Who's going to come? The town is goyless.
Yeah,
who's going to come?
Who's, yeah, who are you calling?
I think 10 miles off.
So what I would do in that situation, in that very hypothetical situation, I probably would not call because I'm wondering if I just plugged it in myself, kala'achayad, from a righty, I use my left hand, I would knock it down another notch. And that would probably be equivalent to picking up the phone and bothering someone else.
The power's out.
But isn't that violating?
You just said do it with your left hand.
Do it with your left hand, man. You do it differently.
Isn't that violating the biblical law?
It's not heat or light. No, it's a freezer. It's not heat or light. Produces heat, but that's incidental. And the light also doesn't. It's not. It's a midrabana. And kalachar yad, it's probably the best thing under that. If you're righty, do it with your left hand. That's what I would tell you. If you don't want to lose hundreds of dollars worth of meat, I hear you. The rabbis are trying to be sensitive here.
Why would you get hundreds of dollars?
I don't know. It's not my kitchen.
Just eat the damn
frozen meat. Okay. Look at number 3. Considerable pain. I want to be very clear about the next one. It says considerable pain. We're not talking about a life-threatening situation. What is the halacha, guys, if there's a life-threatening situation?
You break Shabbos
yourself. What did we say last week or 2 weeks ago? It's a mitzvah to do that, and you have the greatest Torah scholar do it. You don't start looking around for your fellow non-Jew. Now we're talking about just someone who's in pain. And it's not just like a little, it's painful. Let's say you got a burn on Shabbos. So you want to put some ointment on the burn, and you don't have any ointment. So you can ask your friend to go to the store, here's the money, take some money from my drawer, and get me some ointment, please. Sorry, my favorite one is the fourth one, human dignity. Shows the values of Judaism. If your human dignity is compromised in some way, it would be permissible for you to ask a non-Jew to otherwise, for example, you're walking to MGE on Shabbos morning, you're trying to get there on time. I just threw that in, that was gratuitous. You're trying to get there on time, and there's this huge, disgusting New York City, you know, puddle of muddy water, and a big semi-truck splashes by and splashes all the water over your beautiful new blouse. So, what do? You got to just walk to shul, and you don't want to go back home, and you have a friend. You see if you can send him into a store. You can do whatever is necessary, basically, to get a new blouse. As long as you yourself are not doing it, you can ask someone who's who's not Jewish to help you out, even if it means, you know, them handling money and going into a store and buying it on Shabbos. Okay, those are all things, by the way, that permit you to violate something which would otherwise be rabbinically forbidden for you to do. The next six categories allow you to ask a non-Jew to violate something which would otherwise be a biblical violation for you. For example, settling the land of Israel. I know this is a very obscure mitzvah, but it's okay in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, to settle the land of Israel. It's a mitzvah to go move there, to live there, to enable a fellow Jew to live there. It's okay to ask a non-Jew to do something which otherwise would be forbidden biblically. Can anyone think? Okay, there's only one scenario that actually ever happened. There were land sale auctions that took place in the 1920s and the 1930s that took place purposely on Shabbos because Arabs that were living in the areas didn't want Jews bidding on the land and buying property. So they held the land sale auctions on Shabbos. Rav Kook, who was one of the great rabbinic minds of the 20th century, was also the first chief rabbi of the state of Israel, permitted Jews to be driven on Shabbat to the land sale auctions so that they could bid on properties in Israel. Driving in a car on Shabbat would otherwise be what kind of violation? Biblical or rabbinic?
Biblical.
You're not doing it yourself. You're having someone drive you. But it's okay to have someone do something which would otherwise be a biblical violation because what's the mitzvah involved? Settling the land of Israel. Okay. I don't know when the last time that ever happened to anyone here. But it's an interesting scenario. The next one is actually much more practical. Twilight. What's twilight in Hebrew? Bein hashmashot. What's it in English? It's about 30 minutes between sunset and nightfall. The twilight zone. You've entered the twilight zone, and in Judaism, the twilight zone is what? Is a big debate. Does the 30-minute period between, approximately, it could be 30 to 40 minutes, does that 30 to 40 minute period belong to the day before? Or is it the next day? It's a debate. And since it's a debate, you have a little window during that 30, 40 minute period after Shabbat has started, not to violate any of the 39 acts of work yourself, but to ask a non-Jew to do that on your behalf, even if it would otherwise be a biblical violation, as long as it's during that 30-minute period. For example, couldn't get the light candles on time. You could actually have a non-Jew light the Shabbat candles for you. They can't make a blessing, because they're not commanded to do this, but you could ask them, I just missed it by 5 minutes, but it's got to be within that 30-minute window of candle lighting. You could ask them to light the candles, you could ask them to turn a light on if you want to read, you could ask them to do anything that you needed to do for Shabbat that you didn't get to do. Now, got to be careful with this. You don't want to start relying on this. This is just the situation where you're in. You tried your best to get ready for Shabbos. Something went wrong. You couldn't. But you've got that 30-minute window if you have someone who isn't Jewish to do those things for you. Why? Is it okay? Because everything gets reduced a bit because it's Bein Hashmashot. It's a question as to whether it's Shabbos already or it's the day before. Now, we treat it as Shabbos. But for the sake of this, for the purposes of this halacha, you could rely on non-Jewish help on Shabbat for, during that period of time.
So you could ask them to prepare the steak medium for in twilight.
You could, except you could.
You can only eat food made by another Jew, though.
Right, so that's another separate issue which we can discuss another time. There's a separate rabbinic prohibition called Bishul Akum, which is non. That's why we have mashgiachs and people turning on ovens in kosher restaurants. We're not supposed to. We're not referring to coffee or tea or toast, but a piece of meat or something substantial. We are not supposed to have it fully cooked by the non-Jew without any Jewish involvement. Doesn't matter. That would still be a problem even on a Tuesday. That's what I'm trying to say. That's called Bishul Akum.
Your words count as doing part of the cooking.
What do you mean, do your words?
I mean,
we're talking about words. It wouldn't have gotten done without the words.
Right, and therefore?
So you might have been involved in the cooking.
Oh, is that enough? No. You have to physically do something. You have to stir the pot. You got to put the flame on. You got to do something physical in order for it not to be what's called bishul akum, cooking of a non-Jew. So, I don't really want to get into it now. We'll talk about it another time. We talk about the laws of kashrut. It's a rabbinic prohibition. Mm-hmm. Also, it is linked to idol worship.
Yeah.
It is also linked to one of the reasons why we don't have why we have kosher wine, even though the ingredients are the same ingredients as everybody else. What's not kosher about wine? So the handling, it's the same. It's all part of that same category. So that's the only issue with your example. But there are a lot of other good examples of this, of things that you could get done if you're in that pickle situation, you know, during that 30-minute period. You can rely on non-Jewish help on
Shabbat.
You mean,
yeah,
same thing, shots. Same thing. In other words, on Saturday afternoon, during that 30-minute period between when the sun is beginning to set, but it's not nightfall yet, there is actually a debate, but there are opinions that say you could rely on non-Jewish help on Saturday also during that time. Good question. All right. Oh, God, I'm skipping over inevitable consequences. It's just too complicated. It's really complicated, but it doesn't come up that often. Look, let's go to four, illness. What do I mean by illness here? Because you know that if someone is in a life-threatening situation, you do it yourself. We talked about considerable pain. You can ask somebody. What about if someone is not in pain, but they're not feeling well? If they're not feeling well, it can't just be like a little headache. It has to be something. You have the flu. Something which is requiring bed rest. Then you could also ask someone who isn't, Jewish, let's say, to drive to the pharmacy and get you some medicine or do something for you to help you out, make something for you. They can cook you tea or something like that. That would be okay. Or if you're not bedridden but you have intense pain, that really weakens you, that would also permit you to do this as well. Last two examples are really interesting. Public mitzvah. What does that mean, a public mitzvah? If there's a public mitzvah involved, that is what's really the Shabbos goy. Any mitzvah that the community needs becomes a public mitzvah. And you could have the non-Jew turn the lights on for everybody, turn the lights off, the women are cold, the men are hot, and has anyone been like to synagogue on Yom Kippur? The women are always complaining it's cold, and all of a sudden it gets warmer. The men kvetch that it's getting too hot, and all of a sudden it gets cooler. That's because the poor guy, is putting the heat back up and down all day. Okay, that is the rabbis, carved out these leniencies within the rule because we wouldn't be able to gather. There's just and not only that, there is. When you have the public in mind, then more becomes permissible because you're dealing now with not just your individual needs, but with the communal needs. So that's another example. Last exception is the possibility of widespread transgression. This actually happened to me last Passover. If the only way to prevent many Jews from violating stuff is to ask a non-Jew to fix something, can anybody think of an example of that? Something might break on Shabbos, and then everybody's just going to be in violation of something.
Well, if your
Erev goes down, it's a storm, and you can't get word out to everyone. By the way, the Erev went down; we technically can't carry. Everyone's going to be carrying, violating one of 39 acts of work. You can have somebody go fix the Erev on Shabbos. Actually, this happened last Passover, finishing up. Ooh, it's late. Okay, we'll end with this. So last Passover, two Passovers ago, I was giving a speech. I was in one of these hotels with a lot of people. I was giving a talk. This woman comes running up to me in the middle of my talk, and she says, "The Erev is down." I was like, okay. I'm like in shul. I got my talis on. I'm like in the middle of this great speech, I thought. And she's, yeah, it was Shabbos. Excuse me. It was Shabbos. Now, here's the quandary. And that's, the quandary is, you know, it was a pretty diverse group. There are a lot of very religious people there, and they're not such religious people there. Now I'm telling people that the Erev is down. Is that a good thing? Remember we talked about ignorance is bliss? Is it? I don't think so. Maybe after you walk out of this class, you're thinking maybe I shouldn't know so much. Ignorance is not bliss. You should know this stuff. It's really, really important. But I wondered to myself, you know, I don't want, like, oh, well, I'm not going to follow it anyway. Now they know it's not up. So whatever it is. But there were enough people there that I felt like, as a rabbi in the hotel, like I have to tell them just for the, you know, until we get it fixed. And that's what we did. We had some of the help in the hotel fix it. Yeah. Right, you're not right. So bidyevet is a very good term that Yitzhak is bringing up. You don't plan these things. It'll be like, oh, I got the 30-minute window. No, you got the 18-minute window with the candle lighting. That's it. Okay, but the 30-minute is if you're something happened, you got caught in traffic, and now you didn't have time to heat something up.
Like worst case scenario.
Right, but that's what this is for. This is, guys, the point of this is that it's doable. It shouldn't be so strict and so difficult that we just forget and you throw up your arms and, like, you know.
The other thing I have is what, maybe you can figure out the 30 seconds or 45 seconds, time constraints, but what level of scholarship would you say, or religious knowledge would you say people should have before they rely on one of these, before they decide to have one of these leading opinions, as opposed to going and asking a question to a rabbi who's actually...
If you know it, you know it. If you know the principles... If you, that's why I'm teaching, guys. If you know the principles, you can answer this stuff yourself. If you're not, you know, I've been doing this for many years, so, and I've spent more time studying it, but let's say there's no rabbi around to ask.
Is there a risk of maybe doing something that we think it's like this, but it's not really like this?
Right, obviously, if you're not clear on the information or you're not confident that you're being objective, you know, I'll sometimes ask a question, even I know the answer, but maybe I'm not being objective because it's me. I'm the one who's involved here. You know what I mean? So I think it really depends on the person. Ideally, you should be able to answer these questions yourself, but that's why you got rabbis around to help out a little. Alex?
I think I know the answer, but we'll just politely hear it. I mean, I guess, you know, asking a fellow Jew to do something, even if they're not observant.
Right, now,
you know,
I'm really glad you asked that, because we went the whole night without discussing that. We all have friends, I have plenty of friends who are not observant, we don't do that. We don't do that, because they are just as commanded in observing the Sabbath as we are. So that would be, you know, I would do it myself before asking someone who is a fellow Jew. And there's no difference, really. We really look at it that way. There really is no difference. And by the way, this is very, very important. God forbid anyone should walk out of here and think that we somehow are looking down or don't think as highly of our fellow non-Jews because, oh, they can do this stuff for us. Let them be our little Shabbos guy. Please don't misunderstand that. Just because they're not commanded to do these things doesn't mean that we don't respect them or they're not as valuable Jewishly, spiritually. Everybody has different roles. They happen not to be commanded in the observance of the Sabbath. So we can rely on their help a little. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as you do it in a respectful manner. Yeah, last question.
Okay. Is there an idea of if they're going to benefit from that thing?
Yes, I forgot. We don't have time. There is an idea.
Okay.
There is a little idea, but there are exceptions to the idea, which is, here's the deal. So Medina, I mentioned, she came, she saw me sitting in the dark, squinting and trying to read my thing. She put the light on. I was like, oh great, now I can't enjoy the light because she did it for me. But if Medina came in and sat down, she knows to do this now, and opened up a magazine and just chilled out, which we do with her all the time, and she, now, it's like that's totally cool. It's totally cool.
I don't know about
it's
that.
Perfectly fine. You want to hear another loophole?
She sits down, she's like, oh, I'm just going to read here, and I'm done.
No. That's a fake reading.
That's a fake. But she's trained now to know what you want.
It's fine.
She's fine.
I'm fine, and I'm comfortable with that. I've made my peace with that. I'll tell you another. You want to hear a trick?
Yes.
And it's in the Art Scroll book, in the footnote. No one reads the footnotes. I do. Okay?
I do.
You want to hear the trick?
Yeah.
I can't find I need the light on in my bedroom because I need to look for something in the bedroom, but I can't put the light on Shabbat. I can't. Can I go ahead and say, Medina, do me a favor? I need the lights on in the bedroom. Cannot do that. It's forbidden benefit from. But if I say to Medina, I forgot my sneakers in the bedroom. Can you do me a favor? Can you just grab me my sneakers? It's pitch black in my bedroom. So she goes into the bedroom to get my sneakers. She's going to put the light on so she can see. I then dive in there. And after the light is on, and I go, leave the light. I just got my light on. Did I not?
I didn't forget my sneakers. You do.
Okay, now, I'm not saying, and I'm not suggesting you play these little games, but if you figure out the rules...
Man, the Torah makes it sound really fun.
This is how religious Jews have fun on Shabbos. Like, go get my sneakers. Wait! Oh, ah! Now... You can have that person turn the lights off, but just not on. Remember, we talked about that difference before. All right, I don't want to keep you guys too late. I apologize. Have a wonderful Wednesday night. And thank you for yelling out ridiculous things and smiling and laughing for no reason. And here is Rabbi Pinney. Yes, we're coming up to Fusion right now.
No, don't get so situated.
Oh, look, and no one said stop.
Stop.